Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, it's Friday, 7 o'clock, and it's time for Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, and my co-host, Neil Denny. This week we're interviewing Arati Prasad, and I'll hand straight over to Neil to introduce Arati.
Thanks, Padraig. Arati Prasad is a biologist and a science writer. She has appeared on TV and radio programmes, including as a presenter of Channel 4's controversial Is It Better to Be Mixed Race? And Brave New World with Stephen Hawking, as well as BBC Radio 4's The Quest for Virgin Birth. And she's written for Wired, The Guardian, and many other publications. Previously a cancer genetics researcher at Imperial College London, she subsequently moved out of the lab and into the world of science communication and policy. Arati's here tonight to talk about her book, Like a Virgin. So, Arati, thank you very much for joining us on Little Atoms tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, we're going to be talking about Like a Virgin, how science is redesigning the rules of sex. And it starts off with a fantastic history of basically the idea of where babies come from, I guess, what sort of things people have thought historically. So let's talk about that first of all.
Yeah, and part of the reason I wrote it was because I was quite fascinated with the gender roles, especially the ones women were assigned over history, and how there was a big gap between two ideas that resonated throughout millennia. And one was that females were capable of having virgin births, and the other was that females weren't capable of doing anything in pregnancy except for holding the baby as a vessel carrying the child. And these ideas, I think you can trace them back at least to ancient Egypt, ancient India, and then to ancient Greece. Because before that, I mean, in Bronze Age times, you were seeing statues that personified humans representing females, mm-hmm. and corpulent females. So females that who looked fertile, had big breasts and big stomachs, because women were worshipped then as givers of life, which makes complete sense because you saw women growing bigger and having a new human being. I mean, how amazing must that be? And for most of human history, you weren't allowed to, for many reasons, dissect. And even when you could dissect, you couldn't dissect females. So these myths were perpetuated throughout a lot of history. But so you jump from this idea of females being able to create life and these goddesses, fertility goddesses, to something happening where the status quo changed and women were restricted in terms of their positions in society, but also in what they were supposed to have provided in terms of reproductive capacity. So I was quite interested in this kind of juxtaposition of two ideas and how that perpetuated until ridiculously recently. So until up until, you know, late 19th century, it was still in medical textbooks, some of these ideas.
As well as that being like just the technology being, you know, having to be brought to bear on those subjects, there were people like Galen, for instance, who was such an authority that people just didn't question his ideas for hundreds of years.
And even when they did, so Leonardo da Vinci actually did dissect and he did question and he did experiment. And yet, in the drawings he did, you can see the ideas of Galen and Aristotle trickling in. That, for example, a female was an inverted version of the male, and so the male bits were just reflected in the female, but they didn't know what they were doing, mm-hmm. and they couldn't have been quite so important. It's sort of, these ideas are really hard to get rid of. I have to say, I mean, recently there was a study you must have seen about the perception of women in science.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, giving the same CV in and changing the name to male to female. And even now we think we're enlightened and we're not at all sexist and we're completely equal in giving people jobs. You still found this unconscious bias. It's not surprising that 3,000 years ago that unconscious bias was still there. But the thing about women being able to be virgin mothers was quite interesting because even Aristotle did note that there were animals, you know, who naturally had babies without males. For some of these animals, he's a little confused because there were some species in which male and female look quite similar, so you couldn't really tell the difference. It was a bit confused. But he did make those notes. And, you know, the interesting thing is that there are, obviously, no animals in the world that have only male species, or male species, but obviously there are many that have only females. And that's because from the egg, comes everything. You know, all the bits that you need to build, all the layers of a new animal. And a sperm essentially, I mean, does other things, but essentially it's a packet of DNA. So even when the person who actually discovered that aphids were able to reproduce without sex, he was the same person who said that the sperm were the all-powerful. So it just didn't seem to make sense. But there must have been this psychological subconscious block that even though they were seeing in front of them evidence, they wouldn't accept it.
Before we go on to look more closely at the concept of virgin birth, both in the sort of mythological terms and in the, you know, the literal, you know, parthenogenesis and in the natural world, let's look at sex itself. It's how we all got here, and it's what most of us think about most of the time, I guess. But it always comes as a surprise to know that it's actually... It was only one of a number of possible evolutionary strategies. And in some way, it was, you know, it was a thing that was we didn't do before, and then suddenly we did. It was invented, for want of a better word.
Yeah. When, just going back to the formation of eukaryotes, so multicellular...
I'm talking about my very distant ancestors.
But that was a significant change from prokaryotes and development of eukaryotes, because then what you had was a nucleus, and inside the nucleus you had your DNA, which is your instructions for building a new, your progeny. But it was locked up. How do you get it to swap information with another being to get beneficial genes from them? Bacteria can take bits of DNA, absorb into them, do various things. But eukaryotes have this problem. It's all locked up. There are two sort of benefits of sex that biologists talk about. And one is limiting mutations, so that if you have two sets of DNA coming together and swapping bits, if one of them has a mistake in it, you could get a copy from the other version correcting that mistake. So that's why it's interesting, because it sounds like sex limits diversity. But the other reason for the popularity of sex, we're talking about 99.2% reproducing in this way, is for adaptation. So as environments change and you have the assault of changes, many changes in the kind of place you're living in, and also from infections and parasites, if you have the ability to swap genetic material with another individual, then you're more likely to have a sort of arsenal of variety to be able to defend yourself against the attacks of parasites. So there's this sort of two-pronged, you know, there may be other reasons, but these are ones popularly talked about.
But there are obvious drawbacks. If you're talking about animals that are living out on a savannah being hunted by predators and stuff, there are obvious drawbacks. And very specifically for females, there are more drawbacks. Let's talk about some of the drawbacks of adopting sex as the reproductive strategy.
So for females, it can be harmful physically. It can also, it does also expose you to transmission of viruses and infections. And it dilutes your DNA in half, if you see what I mean, when you pass your DNA on. So probably the biggest drawback is, from the start, is you have to find a mate in the first place. Mm-hmm. And for some animals, it's easier than others. And they solve it in different ways. I mean, if you're an earthworm, you know, kind of trudging around underground, they are hermaphrodites, so they can, if they had to, reproduce on their own. So there are different kinds of animals in nature that can produce offspring without sex, but it's not a one-size-fits-all, because there are many, many different strategies for doing that, which are fascinating.
You're talking about the animals that can adopt that strategy, I guess, in extremis. So if there's a point where they can't find a mate, then they're able to sort of adopt that strategy.
Yeah, and so recently, I think it was 2001 onwards, we started seeing bigger animals. So we kind of knew that the aphids did it, and we knew that snakes did it. But finding sharks and Komodo dragons, I think, was quite an interesting thing, because these animals in which it was recorded were being kept in zoos because they were endangered. So, for example, there are only two female Komodos in all of Europe. I think there are only about 1,000 anyway on the planet. Mm. And when you keep an animal in breeding programs in a zoo, you keep them alone. So you keep the females alone. So the one in Chester and one in London. The one in London has now died. So the one in Chester, what would happen is when you wanted to breed it, you'd bring in a male from a stud book. So the male's lineage would be very well recorded. You bring that male in, you throw them a piece of meat. It's like a dinner date. Kind of come together with a piece of meat, theoretically, and mate. But you see, there was a zookeeper at Chester who decided to pick up some of the eggs, because they lay eggs like chickens that aren't fertilised. But he said he had a zookeeper's whim. He thought he'd just pick them up and put them in the incubator. And lo and behold, quite a few of them hatched into males because mm-hmm. the way their chromosomes are, like turkeys as well, they have a kind of the opposite of humans. So she had sons, which throws the whole stud book thing into disarray now because no one actually knows who fathers are anymore. They haven't bred these sons with anyone because they're worried about the genetic diversity. But yeah, I mean, keeping these, and it happened with the two shark, bonnet head and black tip, that you're keeping them alone, mm-hmm. and therefore it's almost as if that Komodo was washed up on a desert island, say, and didn't have any males around, rather than go extinct, she could she could reproduce on her own. So that kicks in. That's called facultative, so you have the option of doing that. But there's some animals that don't have males at all, like the whiptail lizard. So that species of lizard came about when a male of a related species mated with a female of another related species, and their daughter had a mutation, random, which meant that she was able to just have baby lizards on her own. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting about these animals is that they're mating, even though they're all females, there aren't any males, they're called lesbian lizards very commonly because they enact a mating ritual. And you have one female acting as a male and one acting as a female. So passive, you know, the typical things you see on the Discovery Channel. But what's very interesting is if you dissect both of them after this mating ritual, it's very, very fascinating because the female who was playing the male role, her eggs are immature. Nothing's happened. The female playing the female role has had her eggs have kick-started into development. You know, they're ready to become baby lizards. No one knows why this happened. So a trigger is needed. For some animals, like there's a type of salamander, the type of parthenogenesis that the salamander does is called kleptogenesis, mm-hmm. like kleptomaniac, and they borrow or steal sperm. And they do that to kickstart the egg into developing, but they never incorporate any of the DNA from the father into the child.
Just little atoms, we're halfway through the show, and we're talking to Arthur Prasad. At the start of the programme, we talked briefly about early societies and the artefacts we see from early societies, these very full-figured, voluptuous women clearly capable of bringing forward life, and about the wonder that must have been of where the hell did this come from when the baby came out. Can we talk through maybe, you know, I mean, we have a pretty good idea where babies come from now, but can you maybe talk through how different ideas developed over the centuries of how this process occurred among humans?
Yeah, one of the ideas I find quite interesting is that, it's this come through from Greek times as well, is that everything is contained in sperm. Mm-hmm. So the egg's making they didn't know genetic, but inheritance. No component is being inherited via whatever the mother gives. Mm-hmm. She's merely serving as something to carry the child. And the idea was that inside sperm was everything needed to create the child. One idea that they had was that inside the sperm there was a mini human, a homunculus, or body parts that in the mother's womb just came together and assembled into a baby and then popped out. So it was an incubation system. Or there was a complete being inside the head of the sperm. And one scientist even claimed to have seen it under a microscope. It was a hoax, but it just caught fire and people started to believe that. So weird and wonderful. A lot of the things I found in writing the book were you just couldn't make them up, but they were accepted as facts for so long.
Talking about that, you know, the ancient worship of the Willendorf Venus and this fertility thing, another idea that has always been with us, it seems, through you know, many ancient cultures is this idea of the virgin birth. So why was that so popular, do you think?
Yeah, I think that also is because they couldn't really explain where babies came from. But it seemed to be a good way of... I think there's a whole other societal religious aspect to that as well, in that it made... If you were considered to have been born of a virgin mother, that made you special. Mm-hmm. So even men who weren't gods in their lifetime, in hindsight, their mothers were given virgin mother status, mm-hmm. like Genghis Khan, like Alexander the Great. If they're a great army general or achieved great things, they were then, you know, gone back in the records with... fudge a little bit. But again, these stories go right back to ancient Egypt, and there's a particular story of a queen called Malkmus who was visited by the Holy Spirit and told that she would bear a son. And then she kissed a cross, the Crux Honesta, which, yeah, it just has resonances of, mm-hmm. You know, the most popular virgin birth story. And funnily enough, every virgin mother... Roman, Christian, oops, Mary, Egyptian. Their names all start with sound, meh.
Mm-hmm. As if they're all derivatives of the same
name.
And
they could well be derivatives. Because you have early church fathers who you know, were trying to get people to accept Christianity in Roman, newly Christian Rome, and were saying, oh, you know, if you can accept that these gods were born of a virgin, why can't you accept that Jesus is? And even animals, you know that animals can create, and if God wished this, then it could happen. So you could see them building on what was already believed to try and, well, convert people to the idea that this man must be spiritual or special because clearly his mother was a virgin. So it's very complex. It's a mixture of biological and societal and spiritual, I think.
Well, that's, you know, it's one thing back in, back in Roman times, but in the book you talk about an absolutely amazing story of a hunt for a virgin mother in a newspaper's hunt for a virgin mother in the 1950s. So tell us quickly about what happened there.
Even that, actually, I don't think that was quite so silly as it sounds, just because it was initiated unwittingly by a scientist. In the 1950s, scientists were discovering fish, a lot of animals that were genuinely having virgin births. And there was a scientist up in Edinburgh, Richard Beattie, who even suggested that maybe we should use this as a method of raising animals on the farm, because why should we invest so much resource and money into raising big male animals that tend to be big for the sake of a little sperm? So why don't we breed animals to get them to produce virgin births? It was an idea, and they did it for turkeys. There's a line of turkeys called Beltsville that were having parthenogenetic births. So there's a geneticist called Helen Spurway at UCL, and she gave a talk about her studies in guppies. And someone asked her, so, you know, if this could happen in guppies, do you think it happens in humans? And she said, yeah, I mean, maybe it does. But women wouldn't come forward for fear of social stigma. But if there was a panel of scientists to test and study them, then they'd be more likely to. And there was a journalist who came to hear of this called Audrey Whiting, who was at the Sunday Pictorial, which is the forerunner of the Mirror, I think. It's a tabloid journalist. She was very popular with the stars, Liz Taylor, you name it. You know, she was a royal reporter as well. And she pursued Helen Spurway to get the story from her. And I gather she followed her around because she seemed to have cornered her in a corridor at LSE and said, I really want to talk to you about this story, to which Helen Spurway said, I do not speak to the popular press. But she got her story anyway, and it made the front page, and it ran for, I think, 8 months. And because she announced it as a search for a virgin mother, she said, a scientist says that this is possible, and if you think that you've had a baby and not in the natural way, then get in touch. And 11 women came forward. Of them, I think about 8 thought that they were virgin mothers because they had an intact hymen. And then so the paper published another explanation of what a virgin mother is. And it said, a virgin mother doesn't need to be a virgin. She needs to have believed that the conception of the child happened at a time when she was not with a man. So they then knocked out the other 3, I think, because their eye colour or their blood types did not match. And there was one pair left, a daughter and mother, 10, 11-year-old girl, and her mother, who's a German woman, who was in Germany in a sanatorium for rheumatism at the time she got pregnant, and it was all female. And she could never, she wrote that she couldn't understand how she got pregnant, and she even laughed when the doctor told her that she was. And so they ran this battery of tests. It was published in The Lancet. I mean, it's a serious test that will now, it's a sort of dubious quality ethically, not quality, but ethically, because, you know, they did a skin graft on the daughter and the mother and that sort of thing. But they passed all the tests. So these tests were, they obviously didn't know about DNA until 1953, so that was only a few years later. But they did proxies for chromosomal similarity, like taste tests for a substance called phenylethylurea, which either tastes, you don't taste at all, or it tastes terribly bitter, depending on, I think it's a gene on chromosome 19. So you can see it was going back to really what was on the genes, but they couldn't pin it down. And blood test, the final test was a skin graft test. And that didn't quite work out. That was supposed to be the most important test, but it was rejected in a way that was unexpected. Now, if the child was a clone of the mother, she would have been... And, I mean, a child from a virgin mother would not necessarily be a clone, because like Komodos have sons, turkeys have sons, and mothers are mothers, not males. Because every egg has a little bit of a shuffling, because when eggs are produced, there's a thing called meiosis, which means that the DNA shuffled a bit. So you won't have any more DNA than your mother did, but you won't have it exactly the same way. But still, the skin grafts should have taken better than they did.
You sort of preempted this, but I was going to say that there is an obvious thing that if we're talking about Jesus being of a virgin birth. There's like sort of obvious biological thing that precludes Jesus from being a virgin birth in the fact that he was a boy. Yeah. But you're sort of saying that actually that's not strictly true anyway.
It is in humans. So Komodos have a ZW system in there. We have XY or XX. So females, humans have XX if you're female. So you can only ever, in any of your eggs, have an X or an X. You can never have a Y, so you can never get, that egg could never develop into an embryo that's carrying a Y chromosome. Therefore, you can never have a son.
We get these every so often, it seems every couple of years now, someone comes out with a book about, I think the latest one is just called The End of Men, but it starts off with social things and then throws in, and biologically as well, in 100, couple of millennia, whatever, their reproductive need for a male in human terms will be entirely finished with. Is that a realistic, I mean, it's possible, but is it a realistic way to, that the species could actually continue?
Yeah, no, that's because of the idea that Y chromosome has been degenerating, and it has. It's hugely degenerated. Y chromosome's hugely degenerated over time, but it's stabilised. Mm-hmm. So you could say that the genes that are left are the ones that are absolutely essential for maleness, and it's not degenerating anymore. But even if it did, there are lots of animals that have no male chromosome. But what's happened is the bits of the chromosome that dictate maleness have jumped to other chromosomes, so transposed onto those, and they function fine. They're not very fertile. They're subfertile, and humans would be subfertile if that happened. And humans are subfertile anyway, because even if you took two 20-year-olds in peak fertility having unprotected sex, only about a 20% chance of getting pregnant, which is pretty poor. Yeah, I don't think men... Okay, if they could become less fertile, but yeah, I mean, that's why scientists... fertility seems to be decreasing in many countries, and scientists have been researching this. But just to end the virgin birth 1950s story, the reason I said it wasn't such a silly thing is because she based it on good principles, and also it wasn't until 1984, so a good 30 years later, that anyone knew that there was a genetic mechanism that meant it was impossible in humans. So before that time, it was free-for-all, really.
Moving on from the idea of actual virgin births, there are ways in which you talk in the book about ways in which the egg can spontaneously do something, not necessarily become fertilised, but do something. And you talk about this idea of something called a teratoma, which is a terrifying thing. So tell us what this is.
Yeah, so I did mention that in 1984 we found out that two eggs couldn't become a baby and two sperm couldn't become a baby because of a genetic lock that's on it. However, that doesn't mean that human eggs don't try. And many mammalian eggs, so it's been seen in goats and horses and guinea pigs and all sorts, that their eggs start developing. So something happens, a signal gets to the egg, it's triggered to start developing without a whiff of sperm. And what happens is you do get, because from the egg comes everything, you do get all the body layers that constitute a fully formed child. So you tend to get things like nails and skin and hair and teeth and eyes, but they look like a mass of spare body parts stuck together randomly by someone who didn't know what they were doing. And teratomas means monstrous tumours in Greek, and they are very frightening looking. But they will never become a baby for the reason that those locks that I mentioned on the DNA you inherit from your fathers, from the sperm, is absolutely essential in creating the placenta. Mm-hmm. And if a fetus doesn't develop with a placenta, then it doesn't have its nutritional system and can never become a fully formed child.
Well, Padre just raised this, the meme of the idea of the end of men. I was going to raise that, but ironically, from a different angle. You talk in the second part of the book about IVF and the future of fertility treatments and things. Ironically, it seems that the way that artificial things are going is that it's the woman who's being sidelined, because there's this drive to develop artificial womb and the aim to raise children outside of the body. Is that the way things are going?
These things, so what I talk about is things like the generation of egg and sperm from stem cells, embryonic and bone marrow, and also the generation of an artificial womb. But these things are being developed for therapeutic reasons, because there are actually many women who are born without wombs or damaged wombs or have had cancer therapy and had to have the wombs removed at a very young age. And this is why, so the woman who had a womb transplant recently from her mother, that's why she wasn't born with one. So it's also interesting to think that egg donation started as a therapeutic intervention for a young girl who had cancer and who had her eggs died. Mm-hmm. And now look at it, it's like a worldwide industry, even black markets in it. So I think once technology is available, there will be demand for it, because, you know, it's just something people are very, very interested in. But, it's interesting. You can go back to Aristotle and the kind of completeness of men and the incompleteness of women, because you can, from bone marrow stem cells, from females, eggs have been generated, but from males, both eggs and sperm have been generated. But I think, one of the other reasons I wrote the book is because I was just interested in, I thought about gender roles, but society is changing. We want more equality. We're girls being educated just like men, and we're supposed to have this equal society, but we have this huge limitation of our biology. That's not going to change. We're not going to, menopause isn't going anywhere very fast. So I think to answer this, it'll be a mixture of sociological and technological interventions.
We've talked quite a bit about past ideas of sex and procreation. And then further on in the book, you talk about the future and what's going to happen there. But there have been some very odd ideas about artificial insemination as well, haven't there?
Yeah. In terms of bringing sperm and egg together, I think artificial insemination, the earliest record of it goes back to, I think, the 17th century, which is effectively using a turkey baste or something. I think they realised that you had to get the sperm to the egg because some men couldn't do that because of various reasons, things called hyperspadias, deformed penises, openings of the penis. But at the time, they didn't actually know about the menstrual cycle, so they had no idea when an egg was going to be receptive to sperm, and so that tended to fail. So they didn't really, even though they knew you needed both, then they didn't know when they had to come together. So, it was very hit and miss, and all sorts of things were tried. And again, throughout history, it's been incredibly popular. Whenever a scientist or a doctor came out and said, I can do this, there were queues around the block in front of his surgery. So that's something that we have in common with the rest of history. But I think since 1978, when Louise Brown was born, by the time she was born, there were already many women pregnant through IVF. I think ever since that time, and that's something that has never been able to happen before, that conception happened outside a human body and in a laboratory and then was put back into the mother. And that was a great leap forward. And there was lots of protests about it too, always from the Catholic Church, and they still don't like it because it's unnatural and it's messing with life. And I had an Irish journalist ask me, but what does that mean for the soul if things happen that you're talking about in your book? And I said, look, it's been happening since 1978 and these children are perfectly normal human beings.
Test tube soul.
I think because the idea, when you talk about test tube babies, that's a good thing to mention, is you have this idea that the child is somehow artificial and not fully human, and we know now that's complete nonsense. And when people started seeing that these fertility treatments were helping people to have children, they stopped being vocal about it because they thought, okay, well, it's doing some good. And now, going forward, so scientists have been working on creating egg and sperm from stem cells, embryonic stem cells, bone marrow stem cells, because a lot of the time when things go wrong in fertility, and sometimes it's unexplained, but generally when there's a problem with the egg or with the sperm. And so to understand what went wrong, the best thing to do is try to make it yourself from scratch. And so if you can take a stem cell, which is basically a cell given the right chemical conditions that could become pretty much any cell, and give it the right signals to become egg or sperm, you can follow the process through and find out where the mistakes happen and therefore how to fix them. So that's what they're doing. But it's just, to my eyes, an extension of what we already do. But it means that if a man doesn't have sperm or a woman doesn't have good quality eggs, she could potentially, in 20 years' time, because that's when the HIV, I think, it's going to happen, could generate that from her body and have her own genetic children if that's important to her. At the moment, you can't use, in the clinic, a sperm or egg that's not derived from inside the body. But now, with the use of the consultation on mitochondrial DNA, so having three parents, that might have to be revised because you're taking genetic content from three sources and putting it together. So all these things happening that have no historical precedent or medical precedent, but have a very good purpose in therapeutic terms.
We're out of time, so we've been talking to Arathi Prasad about her book Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex. So thanks for coming and joining us on Little Atoms today.
Thank you, Neil and Project.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.